Well, here's a brief synopsis that we've got health privacy problems in many countries. It's not just here, it's the Netherlands, Finland. The USA, in fact, is having the biggest fight. So it's a worldwide problem as modern technology meets traditional healthcare. How are things going to adapt? And the big problem at the moment is that everyone from drug companies to insurers wants access to masses of personal data. They imagine there's a lot of money to be made one way or another, and the ways they hope to make it differ very, very hugely from one country to another, but nonetheless, there are big similarities. At present, non-consensual access to data is against European law. There are attempts to do something about that, which I'll discuss, but there is a foundation in human rights law that cannot be fixed by any UK government short of leaving the European Union and the Council of Europe and abrogating the European Convention on Human Rights. But this doesn't stop the medical lobby trying to carve a huge loophole in the data protection regulation, which would greatly influence how that gets interpreted. And here we've got the problem that the NHS Information Centre, under our old friend Tim Kelsey, is trying to hoover everything up and build an empire. What's going to happen with that? Well, we've been here before. Back in 1998, I advised the Icelandic Medical Association, which was fighting a proposal, a startup company called Decode, which raised millions of dollars from Boston venture capitalists, and had the idea that they'd hoover up everything in Iceland, they'd build a centralized medical record system, and they would pay for this by selling access to the records to Roche, the Swiss drug company. The value proposition was that Icelanders I've got good family trees going back to the foundation of the country 1,000 years ago. They have high prevalence of some inherited disorders, and the idea was that by having the med records, the genomic data, and the family histories, you had a unique lab for doing medical research. Now that didn't work, and one of the reasons it didn't work is that the Icelandic Medical Association persuaded 11% of the citizens to opt out. And then a case went before the Icelandic Supreme Court, which decided that on the basis of European human rights law, the same law as the law here, then such systems should be opt-in rather than opt-out. And that caused the system to collapse. A small number of people in Iceland made very large amounts of money, but over a third of the Icelandic population lost a substantial amount, because when the stock price of Decode hit a bubble, lots of people bought shares and then it went pop. And their money was gone. Now, one of the most important cases here is the IV Finland case of the European Court of Human Rights, which became final in 2010. Now, Ms. I was a nurse in Helsinki at the university hospital there, and she was HIV positive. Unfortunately for her, the systems in the hospital there, like systems being deployed all over the UK now, let all clinicians see all patients' records. And so her colleagues found out about her status, and they ostracized her and hounded her out of her job. So she sued for compensation for wrongful dismissal. The court in Helsinki said, well, that's your tough luck. We made regulations about how the hospital system should be, and they abided by those regulations. So she went to Strasbourg, and Strasbourg overturned this. They said, no, the Finnish government should not have arranged things in such a way. It should have seen to it that everybody had the practical right to see to it that their medical records would not be shared with outsiders, with people outside the immediate care team. So like it or not, and the government doesn't, we've got the right to restrict our personal health information to the clinicians who are caring for us. Now try and exercise that right in the NHS and you'll find yourself without care. So, again, we've been here before in 95, 96, when Fleur and I were fighting Stephen Dorrell's attempt to centralise everything. And in 2002, a 40-minute meeting in Downing Street led to the decision to run a national programme for IT, which wasted billions and billions of pounds, the biggest public sector IT disaster so far in human history. And the idea was to replace all the computer systems in the NHS with standard ones, a single electronic health record with access for everyone with a need to know. That slogan actually goes back to 1992. The Is anybody here old enough to remember Ray Rogers?
Yes.
of unblessed memory. Bomb the place. Anyway, so what we saw was that billions were wasted, and the smart suppliers like Accenture dropped out at the start, and you ended up with huge lawsuits and the flagship software which they worked on for years and years and years in Bangalore ended up not working properly. But nonetheless, we got some stuff fielded, and this is already causing problems. Over half of all GPs in Britain are now using systems which are hosted. That means that instead of your record sitting in your GP surgery, GP comes in the morning, he flicks the switch, the system comes up, and your records are hosted in BT's data centre, or in EMIS's data centre, or somewhere else where the customer is not your GP, but the Secretary of State. So a very crucial aspect of control has been lost. What else do we see? Well, we see that in an increasing number of hospitals, receptionists can read your psychiatric case notes. Now, this is something that Fleur and I warned about back in 1995, that you had to have more than one record per person. You had to have a separate way of handling sensitive stuff, as in the thing that Terry was talking about what happens about the 14-year-old who wants their treatment to be in a part of their record that their mummy can't see. You can't do that if you've got a single electronic patient record. You end up trying to put in fudges after the fact, such as sealed envelopes, which don't work, because Whitehall doesn't really want them, so they never get implemented or never work properly. So how does this happen? Well, the theory is that access is based on a role, a legitimate relationship, and the role receptionist needs access to the patient's record so that she can receive him. And there is a legitimate record relationship because the patient's standing in front of you. So if the record is just one record, then the receptionist has access to your psychiatric notes. End of story. Right, that's the problem with that architecture. PDS address book we heard about earlier. Problems, for example, woman suing her GP in the hospital after she was traced by an ex-husband who assaulted her and broke her arm. How was he able to do that? Because his aunt worked at a hospital. Not at the hospital where she'd been treated, but just any old hospital. So suddenly your security perimeter isn't just the 20 people work at your general practice, but these 810,000 people who have got NHS smart cards, and the tens of thousands who have picked up cards that people dropped in the street or whatever. I was speaking in Edinburgh a couple of months ago. You can see the talk online. There they had an issue with an emergency care system, which put everybody's summary record onto one place where it could be accessed. And a GP in Montrose then went and helped him solve the Gordon Brown's records and Kirsty Works and Alex Salmon's and so on. Was he prosecuted? No, that wasn't in the public interest.
Is he not struck off?
Of course not. Who do you think the GMC works for these days? Then there's another issue which we've seen warnings of, and we were told earlier about joined up care. Well, it's already happening in some places where appropriate systems have come into existence, or inappropriate systems, depending on your point of view. There's a pregnancy charity in Oxford, for example, that started warning the Secretary of State, even in the last government, back in 2009, that they were seeing cases where women, particularly poor women in the Oxford area, were reluctant to tell their GP about postnatal depression. Why? Because there the social workers already had access to GP case notes. And they were worried that if they talked about depression, then the social workers might come and take the baby away. And so what can one do about this? Well, we had one small success. After the 2010 election, we managed to kill off the children's database. It's great work there by Terry and Eileen Munro in particular. We shot contact points and we shot ECAF. And we thought that, hey, you know, all the work that we did, writing the database state report for the Joseph Rowntree Reform Trust, getting it adopted as Lib Dem policy, getting chunks of it adopted as conservative policy, and you know, then power changes in the election, we thought, hey, we actually won one for once. And now a couple of weeks ago, Tim Kelsey, the Information Centre, turned around and he says, wouldn't it be great if there were a single database of all children in Britain, so that if you're dealing with a child, you could see all the links they had to police, probation, social work, blah, 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 NHS, GP, hospital, prostitution services, absolutely everything, so that care could be joined up. I know, he says, we'll do it in the Information Centre. Hey, guys, you know, millions of people voted for you and have promised not to do that. Are you not paying attention or what? So what's public opinion on this? There's been a whole series of surveys going back to the 1960s, and they show the same kind of pattern. We're going to see a very recent survey in one of the afternoon workshops where John Carmack, a GP from Essex, re-ran this kind of work. But here's the 2006 survey that Terry and I used in our work on children's databases. People asked whether they supported a central records database with no opt-out. 12% supported strongly, 15% weakly, but more opposed it, whether strongly or weakly, and a few were in the middle. And when you add up the numbers, you see that 53% either oppose or strongly oppose the idea of a central database with no opt-out. And these figures have been stable for years. Other surveys, which look more closely at research, say that most people are generally happy to have their records used in research, provided they're asked. But if they're not asked, then most people are against. And then, of course, there are issues which to do with access to records that have nothing to do with confidentiality. Last time round, in 2009, for example, there was a view taken by the Catholic Bishops' Conference that religious women must have the right to forbid the use of their medical records in research on contraception and abortion, regardless of whether they consider these records to be private or not, simply as a matter, as a theological issue. Women must have the right to say no. And that right, as we'll see, is being seriously undermined. So, in January last year, David Cameron made a speech, which we believe was written by Tim Kelsey, which said that it would be government policy to make your medical records available for research by default, with two provisos. Firstly, they should be anonymised, and secondly, there should be an opt-out, so that people such as religious women would be able to say no. Now, already it is the case in practice that researchers get large amounts of information from existing systems such as HEDS, and we had a case a bit over a year ago with a laptop stolen in London with over 8 million people's records on it. Now, anonymisation of records tends to mean that they get stripped down to postcode and date of birth. And we had a big fight, Fleur and I, with the Chief Medical Officer back in 1995, was it, about this, and we said...
Well, that, out of the room.
Yeah. We said, look, Kenny, postcode plus date of birth identifies 98% of people, because there's four houses in my postcode, right? So the only people that it doesn't identify, where you've got lots of people of approximately the same age living in the same premises, such as Oxford and Cambridge colleges, such as prisons, such as army barracks, right? That's not a huge amount of the population, it's some. So next time we went around, we found that de-identified records were going to mean postcode plus date of birth plus NHS number, or if you were HIV positive, encrypted NHS number. Right? A nice way of signalling somebody's HIV status. Right? 10 decimal digit NHS number is replaced by 16 hex digit triple dose encrypted NHS number. Nice one, good engineering. So hey, we've been here before again and again and again. So anonymisation, we had an earlier mention of CPRD, which you mentioned as making available large amounts of information. We were promised by Tim Kelsey last year at a conference in Cambridge that the anonymity mechanisms that would be used for CPRD that would be made public so that people could kick the tires. And he said then that you couldn't possibly protect such information, that is how the records were scrubbed, because if they were going to be any good for research, then the researchers would have to know what had been done to the data to perturb it or whatever, so that they could write about this when they did the methods section of the medical papers that they then published. So, in the run-up to CPRD going live, we did a Freedom of Information Act request from anonymisation mechanisms, and that was refused on the grounds that if it were published, it would compromise the security of the system. And if you go to whatdotheyknow.org, you can see the entire history of the request and the appeal and so on. We've heard about how GPES is hoovering up stuff from July to the Information Centre. So on the scientific point, how easy is it to anonymise health records? Could you actually do it better? Could anonymisation be the secret sauce that enables research to go ahead despite concerns about privacy? Well, we've certainly got a powerful advocate for it, because there's a chap who believes that anonymisation will solve the world's problems. Many of you may have met this character. He just hired as the government's chief scientific advisor from the beginning of this month. It's Mark Walport.
Yeah.
Sir Mark Walport to you, yes, indeed. So this is a field, statistical security or inference control, which we geeks have known about since about 1980. Now, what got people thinking about this was the 1980 US Census. Before then, the census merely published aggregate totals for different electoral districts in the USA, plus samples of about one census form in 1,000, which were manually redacted and then made available to researchers. And in 1980, they proposed to move to an online database, and they had the idea that people using census data would be able to make queries, which would be responded to if they were responded to on the basis of six or more records. And one of the people working there, a young lass called Dorothy Denning, said, "Now, hang on, I don't think that's going to be secure." And she bet her boss that she could work out what his salary was, given the mechanisms that they were proposing to use. And she won, and she wrote a scientific paper about it, and the whole field kind of snowballed from there. And there are now thousands and thousands and thousands of papers. So, for example, how do I work out what the salary is of my colleague, Professor Anne Kopsick? She is the female professor of computer science at Cambridge. And suppose you run this rule that they run, for example, in New Zealand, where you get answers if it's with respect to six or more records. Well, the first thing I do is say, what's the average salary for all professors of computer science at Cambridge? And I get a number. And then I get a put in a query saying, what is the average salary of all male professors of computer science at Cambridge? And as there's seven or eight of us, I get the answer. And I then pass it to our 11-year-old, who does this thing called arithmetic. And he says, "Dada, the answer is X, right?" Now, this is called a tracker. The idea with a tracker is that you construct a series of allowable queries which give you access to a supposedly sensitive statistic. And it was shown back in the early 1980s that on reasonable assumptions, there are trackers for almost all sensitive statistics. In other words, the anonymity problem is really, really hard from the abstract computer science point of view. Here's a real example. When I was working with Fleur in the BMA, we were asked to kick the tires on a system which was produced by a company called Source Informatics. And what they wanted to do was to collect drug prescribing data from doctors and then sell this to drug companies so that drug companies could figure out how much commission they should pay the salesman. So if you're right, a very, very noble activity there. So if you're a Glaxo and you've got a lass who's the salesman for East Anglia, you want to know how good she is at selling your particular brand of tranquilizers, say, to doctors in Newmarket. So you can work out your bonus. Now, the doctors in Newmarket do not want this pushy sales rep to know exactly what their personal prescribing habits are, because then she'll be just so annoying. You promised that you would prescribe more of our stuff. You haven't, you lying old goat. No more trips to Bermuda for you. So the doctors don't want this personal prescribing information to be released. So what sorts of informatics came up with was the idea that you would simply, for a place like Newmarket with 20 GPs, you would simply have Doctor 1 through Doctor 20, and you would have weekly prescribing totals for various types of drugs. So we looked at this, and we looked at ways in which we could attack it. Here's an example. Suppose you give raw weekly totals, then the drug rep looks at that, says, Doctor 2, aha, that's Sue Smith at the Guildhall practice because she went skiing in the third week of January last year. Hey, got one. And so by means of a number of tricks like this, you can re-identify one doctor after another. So we went through an iteration with source informatics, and we did all sorts of things that were needed in order to make this usable. For example, you can't put in absolute totals, you have to put in percentage market share, and you end up having to perturb the values for different weeks forwards or backwards at random by a couple of weeks and so on and so forth. And once you've done all this stuff, you can just about make this fit for purpose. And the High Court found about 10 years ago that this was in fact okay from the privacy point of view. Now, the point is this: you have to go to this much effort with a very, very constrained application in order to make anonymization work. So it does work sometimes, but only for the application is very restricted, and you can't make it work for the application as general purpose. And so there are various things where you can sort of get a result. You add random noise to mass small values, and then you have to worry about trimming. For example, again back in 1985, there was only one HIV positive patient in Chichester. So how can you possibly deal with issues like that on a per practice basis? You have to start aggregating things, whether it's HIV or liver transplants or whatever, on a national basis. And then, of course, officials say, well, this doesn't give us what we need to do our planning, given the structures that we decided to do our planning, and you end up getting into a fight. One of the things that you can do is random sampling. Now, if what you're interested in is merely monitoring outcomes, seeing which hospital is better than which other hospital, rather than trying to track and trace everybody in the UK, then this is a possibility. What you do there is you say, here's a query that we've written, information that we want about survival rates of liver transplant patients, for example. And you then hash that, and you get from that information which tells you which sample of all liver transplant patients you're going to look at. So out of the perhaps 1,000 patients you might have in the UK, you look at the following 50, and you answer the current query simply on the basis of the records of those 50 people. That gives you a reasonable amount of traction if you are asking specific questions, but that's about as far as you can take it. What you can't do is give people access to longitudinal records. That is the full linked up set of all the facts about somebody. Here's another historical example. Suppose you have got a system which enables you to say, show me the records of all 42-year-old women in the country with 9-year-old daughters, such that mother and daughter both have psoriasis. Right, that is what you would get with the IC dream. That is everybody's records with just the names and addresses removed. Well, step forward, Anne Campbell, MP for Cambridge. Right, this is a description of Anne Campbell back in 1996 when I was doing a briefing on this for the Labour Party when they were in opposition. If you can make a query with that granularity, you can pull one record instantly out of 50 million. So look at what makes it useful. The fact that you have got linked information between individuals, and that is really useful in medical research. The fact that you can get patients' ages, combination of age plus diagnosis, all sorts of combinations can work. There's a lady called Latanya Sweeney at Harvard who has done brilliant work on this. She, for example, managed to pull out the record from the stuff published by the Veterans Administration, which belonged to the governor of the state of Massachusetts. Right, so the Veterans Administration published records that they thought were adequately scrubbed. This turned out not to be the case. So if you link episodes in the longitudinal records, you can re-identify most patients. You add demographic and family data, you're worse off still. You add social data. Well, everything is social nowadays. Every website has got, press the Facebook button, press the like button, add your friends. Hey, there's an amazing amount of stuff leaks out from that. You know, I've got a colleague who's in the experimental psychology department, and he hoovered up a million people's records from Facebook because he wrote an app that a million people ran, and the ethics committee there somehow approved it. The great things, ethics committees. You know, you get your mates to approve your research, and then you approve your mates' research. It never fails, hey. So what he was interested in was to find out how much information leaks through Facebook likes, for example. Now, you know when you press the like button on Facebook, do you know how many likes it takes to tell whether somebody's straight or gay, on average?
Right, I'm sorry, to tell...
To tell whether somebody's straight or gay.
Right.
Six.
Four. Okay. Right, it may be easy for people to present a particular front to other people when they're using only the signals that we as people use, right? But our brains are not evolved to deal with principal components analysis. Okay? Once you see people the way a computer sees people, there's an awful lot more stuff becomes visible. Because there are all sorts of patterns there, which are not patterns that we think of instinctively when we moderate our own behavior in order to present to others the image that you want to present in the real world. So in the world of big data, if you are trying to indulge in a bit of deception or self-deception or presentation or whatever, you're a little bit like a prey animal in the forest that can see only in black and white, where the predators can see in color. Right? You don't know how to choose good camouflage. So there's an issue there. Another example of how things go wrong is that you active attacks. Now, so far, what I've been talking about is what happens if you get a corpus of data, if you go and collect data, if you steal a copy of the New Zealand Medical Database or a million people's Facebook profiles, and then you sit down for 2 or 3 years with your research students and you analyze and see what you can pull out of it. But if you've got a live system that's running year in, year out at the information center or in Reykjavik or Auckland or whatever, then of course it's changing all the time. And so this is something that came up in Iceland. In Iceland, the mechanism was that whenever a medical thing happened, whenever a consultation was finished or whenever a prescription was written, an electronic record would be generated and it would be sent to the Data Protection Registrar's office, where they would take the record, they would scrub out the personal data field's name, address, so on, and replace them with an encrypted social security number. So what's the quick hack to break that? Well, if you want to know what the pseudonym in the system is of David Odson, who was then the Prime Minister, you simply get a tame nurse to write a prescription for aspirin for him and put it in the system, and then you watch how the system changed over the last 5 seconds, and bingo, there it's turned up, you've got it. Right? If you have got a dishonest insider who can collude with just one member of healthcare staff, then you are toast, believe me. David Odson went on to become Iceland's financial regulator. So maybe somebody should have had a go at the so-and-so, but hey. So anyway, that's a brief whistle-stop tour of inference control. There are cases where you can do it if you've got a constrained application, if you really know what you're doing, and if the application remains stable. In fact, at the moment, the source informatics guys have got a problem because the Department for Health is thinking about producing its own system that will do the same thing as theirs does, and if the two of them exist in the world together, then the security of the source informatics system will be broken. There's an example of how these things interact. But once you get outside this world of highly constrained applications, basically, guys, you're a toast. You cannot use statistical security to do what ministers hope it's going to do. And a couple of years ago, there was a law prof in Colorado, Paul Ohm, wrote this in lawyer-readable language. Previously, it was only available in geek-readable language, so lawyers could ignore it. But now it's appeared in a law journal with lots of long, boring footnotes, judges can't ignore it too easily anymore.
So Ross, where is time?
Okay, I'll stop in a couple of minutes then. So the next problem is rogue officials. David Cameron promised that our records would not only be anonymised, but we'd have an opt-out. Right? And you would expect that now Tim Kelton's a senior civil servant, he'd be implementing the Prime Minister's policy. Yet, as we will learn throughout the course of the day, the opt-outs from health systems are like the opt-outs on Facebook. Right? The opt-outs are strange, the defaults are too broad. If you can find the opt-out and you try to operate it, then a year or two later it will have changed, there'll be a different recode, there'll be a different procedure. And you can understand why Facebook keeps on changing the privacy mechanisms. It's to stop people protecting themselves from advertisers. Why on earth should the NHS be behaving in the same way? Transparency, he used to be the transparency czar, so he's making us all transparent. That's great. Problems building in Europe. I'm just going to mention one event before I sit down. It's happening on Friday. The data protection regulation is currently making its way through the European Parliament. A whole bunch of amendments were put down by interested parties. There's an attempt to exempt medical data almost completely from data protection with amendments to Article 81 and 83 of the directive. The gist of this is that you will be deemed to consent to secondary use of your data by the act of seeking treatment. You will be forbidden from opting out afterwards, and you will be forbidden from arguing that the consent was somehow coerced, that it was dunned out of you when you were in pain and on your back. And these amendments were written by the NHS Confederation, COCER, which is the Society of Medical Device Manufacturers, and the Wellcome Trust. And they were introduced by the Baroness Sarah Ludford, MEP, who turns out to be Vice President of LGBT plus Lib Dems, would you believe? So when we found that out, we got a number of gay activists and others that we knew in London to call her up and complain. And she's holding a meeting at Europe House on Friday to explain what she's doing, and a number of us are going to. So the takeaway, you have to think safety and privacy together. Scale matters. A system of 50 million records is too big. It'll be cumbersome, fragile and unsafe. Privacy failure will have real costs in safety and access, especially for those most at risk, as Terry and others have been describing. Paul Thornton, a friend of ours who used to be HIV/AIDS coordinator from Birmingham, tells of a number of cases where people died because they simply didn't seek treatment in time because they were worried about the privacy aspects. And that's not just HIV, that's cancer and a number of other diseases as well.
Suicides and maternal deaths are related to fear of referring to social work. The confidential inquiries into maternal deaths have shown that suicides in pregnant women and recently delivered mothers are related to referral to social services or fear of referral to social services.
There's any number of huge problems here. They're all little isolated problems. You know of some cases, lots of people know of some cases. The thing is that we've got to get this together and tell the story in a coherent way that's loud enough that gets attention. And this isn't as if we're trying to change government policy. Well, we will try to change policy, but at the very minimum, what we want to do is to see to it that officials do what ministers have told them to do. And if officials go out on their own little job, and implement their own agenda contrary to what ministers have said, well then, hey, Mr. Cameron, are you paying attention?
Thank you very much, Ross.